Good afternoon. Okay. I think this mic is on. So, last time we were talking about caches. I'd like to start out by showing you a picture of actual caches. So this is a 2004 processor. I'm using a processor from 2004 because I can actually figure out where the registers are on this, which is a little harder to do for a more recent one. So registers are our fastest kind of storage. Ideally, we'd like to do all our calculations in registers. Unfortunately, we can't quite fit enough in registers to make that actually useful, which is why we have memory. And here, these two red highlights are where the registers are on this 2004 processor. That's the space they take up on the chip, that's where they're implemented. This processor also has level one caches, so the first level of cache. And like most processors, it's split into a data cache and an instruction cache. And this data cache is exactly that data memory box we've been dealing with in our Y86 CPU. And this instruction cache is exactly that instruction memory box we've been dealing with in our CPU. So they're really caches. And hopefully, in the common case, we access these bigger than registers, but much smaller than memory caches when we want to access instructions or data. And notice that if you look here, these caches have a nice regular pattern because they're storing lots, they have lots of copies of similar things. And you can easily see them on a chip. And you know, they take up a lot more space than many other things on the chip. And that's pretty typical. So next to the L1 caches here, this chip has an L2 cache that holds a megabyte. And that's basically half the chip. And this is very common, that the bigger caches are going to take up most of processors physically. You want to try to store as much memory as you can fast, and that takes up space, and it turns out to be worth it. So in this 2004 CPU, this one meg L2 cache is, you know, takes up more space than all the stuff that actually does arithmetic. So on a modern processor, not 2004, but like a 2010, 2015 processor, we also probably have an L3 cache, which means that basically we shrink down this entire thing, and next to it we have an L3 cache. This is a 2004 processor, and the gap between processor and memory speeds was not enough to motivate having a third level of cache. But after you get through all the levels of cache you have on your processor, however many your processor designer decided to have, you get to main memory. And this is often drawn with this sort of pyramid diagram because the registers are just smaller than everything else. And the L1 is just physically smaller and smaller in the amount of data it holds. But these smaller memories, partly because they're smaller, partly because they're built with, you know, less space-efficient components, tend to have lower access times. So on a modern processor, accessing registers typically takes less than a nanosecond. While accessing the L1 cache, those are data and instruction memories, typically takes around a nanosecond. The L2 cache is going to be like 5 to 10, so about an order of magnitude worse for going to the next level of cache. The L3 cache, maybe another factor of 2, like 20 to 30 nanoseconds. And memory is something like 100. So these numbers are approximate, they vary, but what is very universal is that you have this like three orders of magnitude gap between the speed of our fastest storage, which is our registers, and our main memory. And our goal as a processor designer is going to be to let people have the performance of registers all the time, that 1 nanosecond, sub-nanosecond access time.
No.
That should be how their programs perform, but their programs act on data which can only fit in main memory. So any questions about this picture? Yes.
Are the execution units what we refer to as functional units?
Yes, with the exception that there's kind of. So when the label execution units means the execution units that deal with integer operations. There are other things which we would probably call execution or functional units on here, like this load store box and this floating point unit box. But basically, this entire chunk of the chip is execute. So this chunk and this chunk is execute. This and this is memory. And this chunk here is fetch and decode. Yeah?
You might have mentioned this in the very beginning, but how big would this chip be,
How
far
is about the size of your thumbnail?
Yeah, it's probably, yeah, like a square centimeter. And yeah, and since this is 2004, a modern processor is going to have like 25 times the density, something like that. Okay. So, as I mentioned, these first level caches, the first place we look for data, is exactly that data memory box, which means that the real interface to the processor has a few extra components. So we have the things we talked about before. We have that address input, that memadder that you set in HCL2D, and your write, memread, memwrite signals, and your mem input, and we have our usual output. But our cache takes a variable amount of time. Sometimes accesses are fast and don't need to talk to the L2 cache or the main memory, and you get a value right away. Sometimes you don't. So our cache is going to have some extra signals to say, hey, is a value ready for what you requested or not? And if not, the processor will have to stall. And corresponding to waiting for a value from L2 cache, our L1 cache is going to communicate with the next level of cache, or main memory. This is going to be the entity that actually talks to the next level cache. So every time our processor talks to memory, it's going to be through one of the L1 caches. We're never going to have a case where we ever skip that step. So our CPU is going to tell the cache, you know, I want to read some memory address. And sometimes our cache is going to look at that, spend a little bit of time, and forward it to memory. Other times, the cache is going to get a memory address and say, oh, I already got that for you. And it's just going to give a value back without going to memory. So note that this means that accesses which don't hit in the cache, accesses where the cache has to go to memory, actually going to take a little bit longer. But what we really want is to have the typical case be that accesses don't go to memory, because we want to hide that latency. And to meet this goal we had of having the performance of the fastest memory, where we had this 3 orders of magnitude difference, to make that difference not be seen in a typical program, we're going to want a really high hit rate. We want to go to memory really infrequently. And this typically means that we'll be targeting like a 99 or greater percent hit rate on our caches, because that's what we need to hide how slow memory is compared to our cache. That 100 nanosecond wait. Okay. So talked about sort of generalities of a cache. So let's look at something very specific. And let's make a cache. And we're going to start with the simplest kind of cache, which is a direct map cache. And we have to start out by making some decisions. One decision I'm going to start out with is how big a block of stuff do I store in the cache? And I'm just going to arbitrarily choose to store 2 bytes in every block. So I'm going to store a bunch of 2-byte values, and I'm going to have space for 4 of them. And we'll see why I chose 4 a bit later. So we have these spaces for 4 2-byte values, and that's definitely something we need in our cache. And I'm going to lay out memory in a way which corresponds to that 2-byte decision. So addresses 0 through 1 are our first block of memory, where a block is the size we're storing in each slot in our cache. Addresses 2 through 3 is the second, and so on. And I'm never going to deal with communicating between the cache and memory in units which cross block boundaries. So I'm not going to worry about that. So let's say we want to use this cache. So let's say this cache, you know, gets a request from the CPU. And a good request might be, let's read the byte at address 01011, which happens to be this byte right here, this BB. So how does the cache decide how to handle this? So you know that the cache doesn't have the value, but how does the cache know this? The first thing the cache needs to do is it needs to know, like, which of these 4 values does it look at? And we have to make a decision about how we look at these values to, you know, decide whether we have something. And the first decision is, like, where does a particular block of memory end up in the cache? Where do we need to look for it? And I'm going to start out by using the simplest scheme. You'll see why it's simplest, which is direct mapped. And what we're going to say for this is that the first block of memory corresponds to the first block of the cache. The second block of memory corresponds to the second block of the cache, and so on. But the cache has less space than memory, so eventually we run out of, you know, this one-to-one correspondence, and we need to put the fifth block of the memory somewhere. So we'll just start over at the beginning. So the fifth block will go to the first, a memory will go to the first block of the cache, just because we ran out of blocks in the cache. And note that we can number the blocks of the cache, 0, 1, 2, 3. And it happens that these numbers correspond exactly to some bits of the address. And that's not a coincidence. So first of all, if we take a look at this range of addresses, the last bit here tells us which byte of the block we're looking at. So for each of these rows, we have all possibilities for that last bit. So that last bit is not useful for knowing what entry of the cache it is. It just knows, it tells us where in some entry of the cache we're going to find the value. An offset. Then we have 2 bits, which is going to be what happens if we say, take this memory address, strip out that last bit, and divide it by 4 and take the remainder. That's going to be exactly these 2 bits. That's not coincidence. And these 2 bits, therefore, are going to exactly correspond, where, you know, if the remainder is 0, then it's a multiple of 4, the block number in memory. And that's exactly the blocks we've assigned to the first block of the cache. And if the remainder is 1, it's 1 more than a multiple of 4, and that goes to the second block, since we assigned them in order. And the reason I chose to have 4 blocks in this cache is because it works out that we have this exact pattern. We aren't doing something like dividing by 5, where we wouldn't have a regular pattern of the bits. We'd actually need to do real division. When we're implementing the cache, we don't want to have to do division in order to find something. We want something really simple, and we could, like, use a hash function or something like that, but even simpler than that is just taking some bits from the address. So that's what we're going to do. So if we're looking up this BB here, we know it has 0, 1, and those 2 indexing bits of the address. So we know it corresponds to this entry of the cache. So you see, yep, there's a 0, 0 there, 0, 2 zeros there. And Well, we know where the value might be. So it might be that those two zeros. Might not. We need to know, like, first of all, you know, is this value even a value from memory? So to know that, we're going to need to store extra information. We can't just look at two zeros and say, you couldn't possibly have stored two zeros in memory, because we definitely could have. It definitely could be the real value in memory. So we're going to have some extra bit to know, OK, did I actually load a value into memory from memory into this cache entry? Is there something there? So to keep track of that, we're going to have a valid bit. And we're going to set it to 1 when we have something loaded. And when we don't, we're going to have it set to 0. And this means that when we start out our cache, all the valid bits are 0, meaning that we don't have anything from memory in there. So if we're reading this value, the next step the cache would take, because we didn't have the value originally, is loading it from memory. So the cache is going to return what it gets from memory, that BB, but it's actually going to load the whole block, all 2 bytes, so it can fill up this cache entry. So it's going to get these 2 bytes, set the valid bit to 1 because we got a value from memory, and put the AA and BB in there. Now, if later on we look up this address, we'd like to get this BB back. But we have a bit of a problem. So let's say we instead looked up, wanted to get this read 33 from memory. We wanted to read address 3. That's going to go to the same spot in the cache. This is, it has the same remainder dividing by 4 if we take the block number, or the same value for these 2 index bits. And when we read a value, we need to know, is it the one the processor actually asked for, or is it just something else which we happen to place in the same part of the cache? So we need a tag in order, you know, a copy of the address to know. So we could just store the entire address. I could just write 01010 in there, in the cache. I could store that. That would be perfectly correct. This is not quite what the cache does, because it turns out we don't need all that information. We know that if something is stored in this row of the cache, that these 2 bits here, those index bits, had a particular value. They were 0 and 1. So we don't need to save those bits. We can just, that part doesn't matter. It's not going to affect what gets stored there. We also don't need the last bit, because it only says what location in the block it was. If we store the address at the beginning of the block, that's always going to be 0. So we could store that, but we don't need it, so we won't. So we'll just end up storing the remaining bits, and that's going to be called the tag. So this is what we need to implement a functional cache. And it's probably the simplest cache that you might see in a real processor. So questions before we move on? Yes?
Tags only 2 bits, how big could memory be in this case?
In this case, this better be the length of a memory address. Might be 5 bits. And it's only, I'm only doing this because I don't want to use more space in the slide. So the general operation of this simple direct map cache is that we take our address and we divide it into 3 pieces. And one of them is our index. And we have some memory where we send an index to it, and it selects one of these rows. And out of this memory, we get a copy of every single value in the row we selected. And the first thing we're going to do is we're going to take the tag and the valid bit from the memory. We're going to take the tag stored in this row and compare it to the tag part of our memory address, those bits before the index. And if it's equal, then we know, OK, this might be the cache block we're looking for. We might have a copy of it. We're also going to check the valid bit, because if the valid bit isn't set, then it doesn't matter what the tag is. We don't really have something for memory in that entry of the cache. So the first thing we detect is, well, do we have a copy of the value anyways? So is it a hit? The next part is that we need to actually extract the data. This memory address isn't asking for the whole block. It's asking for a particular part of the block. So here, I'm showing reading 1 byte out of a 4-byte block. So you know from your process you're implementing that that's not what you're actually doing. You're reading 8 bytes. I'm just not showing 8 bytes because to make show that example, I need to show you like a 16-byte block. But the same principle is going to be applied. So in a real system, you might have, say, a 64-byte block in the cache, and you might read 8 bytes from it. And we're not going to consider the case where we read something which crosses between two cache lines. So we'll just say we're not doing that. Obviously, real systems do something about that, and the basic answer is they are slow. But we don't have to worry about that since we're reading a byte. So we get these 4 bytes, and we use the offset, the remaining bits of the address after the index, to determine which byte to extract. So we send each byte to a mux, use the offset to select which line of the mux we use, and then we output our data to the CPU. Questions, comments about this diagram? Yeah.
I know why they should compare tag to the tag there, like the two tags.
Yeah.
But can I ask what are the tags there for? Like, what are them?
So the question is, why are the tags here?
Are tags, like, what do they do?
The tags are here so we can remember what part of memory this was. So here we have address 11100 and so on.
Yeah.
We could have address 00100 in the cache instead. Like, that could be stored here. In that case, we don't want to have the processor use whatever bytes we have. So we have the tags so that when the processor asks for an address, if we happen to be storing something in that location in the cache, but it's a value from a different part of memory, we don't want the processor to use it. So we have the tags to know to tell the processor, nope, not your value. Yes?
But the tags aren't necessarily unique. Am I right making that statement? Because there seem to be a lot of values or a lot of memory slots, and if you're only using 2-bit for a tag, they can't possibly be unique over the whole memory.
So we care about the. So. One way we can show that the tag is sufficient is that if we look at this entry of the cache, we can reconstruct its memory address. So the way we do that is the first byte of a block is going to have offset 00. Okay? So that's the bottom 2 bits of the address of this block, is 00. We know that this is in the fourth row of the cache. So the index is 100. And the remaining stuff should be the tag. So we get 11. So from that, we get 11100000 as the address of this block. And that's the whole address. And that's how we know the tag has enough information. You can always look at where you see a tag in the cache and get the whole address back. Yes?
So does each tag, I guess, hold So like with the example in the previous one, it holds 2 different components, and then the offset delineates which one we're trying to access. Does the offset differentiate between which part of the instruction we're trying to get at? Or?
The offset is which part of the entry in the cache, the block, we're trying to get. So in this case, the offset is 2, which means that we're getting 0, 1, 2. That's just B6.
So that allows for us to map multiple values to a single tag.
So the offset is because our cache block can store a larger amount of information than we return from a single read. So here, our read is returning 1 byte, but our cache blocks store 4. So we need the offset to know which of those 4 bytes we take out of the cache block. In the previous case, which of 2 bytes. So this splitting into tag inset and offset, index and offset, is a very important thing to know to understand how caches work. So let's look at how we take this address and find the tag, index, and offset for several different designs of direct map caches. So in this case, we have this address 001111, or 0F in hex, which is stored in each of these caches here, here, and here, highlighted as F. Yes?
Isn't that address actually 1F, not FF?
Sorry, yes, 1F. The FF is the value stored there.
Oh, I see.
So that's why, so it's in these caches as FF. So the easiest thing to figure out from these caches about the sizes of each of these parts of the address and what they're going to be is we can start probably with how big each block is. That's pretty easy. So here and here, we have 2 bytes per block, which means that since an address identifies a byte of memory, we need to distinguish between one of the two. And we need 1 bit to determine which of 2 values we want. So that means that for these 2 caches with 2-byte blocks, we have 1 bit to say which byte of the block we want. And that's going to be the size of our offset bits. And since we always store things which are next to each other in memory in the same block, that's going to be the least significant bits of the address. So there's the last one. For our cache with 4-byte blocks, there are 4 possibilities, which means we need 2 bits to choose between all of them. So the last 2 bits of our address are going to say what byte of the block in the cache we're looking at. So these last 2 bits. So next we can look at how many rows the cache has, which is we're going to call the number of sets. We're going to call each row of the cache a set. And here we have 4 sets. And to just figure out which set we're referring to, we have 4 possibilities. And again, we need 2 bits to decide between 4 possibilities. So our index here is going to have the next 2 bits of the address. And here we need 3 bits to decide between which of the 8 sets we went to look at. So we're going to have 3 bits for that index. And for our simple case, where we have 2 entries, we're going to have 1 bit. And the tag is just going to be everything that's left over. Because we need to know, once we have know the index and offset, everything else needs to be in the tag. Because we remember everything else about the address that we didn't already use in order to make sure that we're uniquely identifying what's in that entry of the cache. And notice that if you lay out the tag, then index, then offset, you can reconstruct the address. So 001111 is the address. And if you read across each of these rows, it's the same address. It's just how it's split up. But we always have the whole address represented by this tag, index, and offset. And always in that order. So, questions about this division? Yeah?
What's the use of the offset if we have the index?
So the index is what row? So we need to know the index to know whether we go to read 0011 or EEFF. The offset is which part of the row. So the offset is going to tell us whether we want EE or FF here. Other questions? Okay. So if you don't like reasoning about this from a sort of how many bits you need perspective, another way you can do this is you can memorize some formulas and do some algebra. And so these are formulas from our book with some simplification since we haven't gotten to associativity yet. And we can say the number of sets is 2 to the number of index bits, which is just another way of saying we need so many bits to choose between all the possible rows. The block size is 2 to the number of offset bits, which is another way of saying we need so many bits to choose between all the bytes of the block. And the tag bits are just what's left over when you account for the set index bits and the block offset bits, and the total size of an address. We also have this notion called cache size. And when we talk about cache size, we're talking about the size of the data, the blocks in the cache. So the cache does have other information stored, like our valid bit and our tag bits. And those take up space. But when we talk about cache size, we're not going to count that. We're only going to count the actual data. So when someone tells you they have a 32 kilobyte cache, they mean that the cache stores 32 kilobytes of blocks. The cache probably also has a whole bunch of extra space to store tags and valid bits, but that's not counted in that size. Which means our cache size for a direct map cache is just the number of sets, the number of rows, times the block size, how wide each row is in the data. So now that we know how to look up things in the cache, let's walk through, you know, how the cache operates given some actual accesses to memory and sort of several cases for what the cache might do. So if you're presented with a picture of a cache and a bunch of memory addresses, probably the first thing you should think of doing is, well, I need to figure out how to split up the address. So the way I'm doing that here is with algebra. So using those formulas from before, I solve for the number of index bits based on the number of rows in the cache. There are 4. And I say there's 2. I solve for number of block offset bits, knowing that there's 4 byte, that should be 2, 4 byte blocks. Solve for the tags. These are 2 byte blocks, and I said 4. So, and now that we've done that, we can split up the address. So we have our index, and our tag, and our offset, just as before. And I've just marked what parts of the address are what, so I can easily figure out, okay, I'm looking at this first value, this address 0, what entry of the cache is that? So I can easily say, oh, it goes to 00, those two things in the middle, that's the index. And the tag is those top 5 bits. And if I look in this cache, I'm going to notice that this is a miss, because here I'm looking at the valid bit and it's not valid. Which means, since it's not valid, what we did before is we're going to copy it from memory into the cache. So we're going to load this address, address 0, into the cache. And as part of doing that, we're going to set the cache line to be valid, because now it has something, even though it didn't before. We're going to set the tag to be copied from that part of the address. And we're going to put the value from memory address 0 in the cache. And since our block here has 2 bytes, we need to also put the rest of the block in the cache. We can't just take part of the value from memory. So we're going to get address 1 in there too. And that means that since this access pattern has spatial locality, our next access is actually a hit. even though it's a different memory address. And this is an example of how caches take advantage of spatial locality. So here, index 0, tag should be all zeros, and it is. And we look at what we're accessing, and you know it's a match, and we can extract this second byte, and that's going to be the value that was requested. And we can keep going through this access pattern. So if we access address 63 in hex, this is index 1, goes here, and we load as before and copy its tag. If we access address 61, it goes to the first index of the cache, and we're going to find that we had 0 stored there before, so the tag won't match. So even though it was valid, the tag didn't match. And that means it's a miss. And on a miss, we're going to copy the value from memory into the cache, which means that since it belongs in the first row of the cache, we're going to replace what was there before. It doesn't matter that we have extra space here at the bottom of the cache, because our policy is that this memory address goes in the first slot. And we have hit. And here, we access address 0 again. Yes?
When you have the miss with 6-1, when you're accessing memory and putting it into the cache, why does it grab 6-0 and 6-1 as opposed to 6-1 and 6-2?
So,
you know which portion of memory you get if you're accessing 6-1 specifically.
So we're always going to grab the thing where the starting at where the offset bits are 0, going through all the possibilities. And that's going to make it so the tag actually gives us the rest of the address. So just because we don't have a way of saying that, we can have a different set of offsets. We could try to do that, but we'd need to add another column to this cache to say, what part of the, what offset did we start at? So rather than do that, we'll always start with the offset bits being 0 and then cycle through all the possibilities. Okay, so here, we're accessing address 0 again. And if you looked at this access pattern, you might say, that kind of looks like it should have good locality. We access, address 0 twice and access address 1. They're just close to it. This looks like an access pattern with good locality, so that should probably be a hit. And it's not. It's a miss because the value that was stored here before was this 6-1 reloaded. And we're going to replace it. And this is a conflict miss. We call it a conflict miss because it's caused by us having two things happen to have the same index. They aren't related values other than that, and it could just be a coincidence. When you're writing code, you don't usually think, hey, are these two things going to have similar bits in the middle of their address? And your compiler generally doesn't optimize in that way. But just because that happened to happen, we run into this case where we get extra misses. This is a problem that is with direct map caches, because direct map caches only have one place to put each value. If we have this unlucky coincidence, we're just going to have lots of misses, and that's going to mean bad performance, because we're going to talk to memory a lot more than we would otherwise, rather than have a copy of a value. And intuitively, we're not getting very good utilization out of our cache space, just because we had that coincidence. Yes? So the question is, does a lot of block offset bits make things slower? So let's think about where block offset bits are involved here. So if we add more block offset bits, this mux gets bigger. So that mux here is going to be slower because it's a bigger mux. So that gets worse. But if we add block offset bits, we probably remove index bits. which means we have less rows, which means that getting this row out might be faster. So it's not, you know, always clear exactly whether it's faster or slower, but there is a cost to adding more block offset bits. The other part of the cost also is that this row is larger, so you have to talk to memory more to get a copy of it. Other questions? Yes.
Can you do a bullet slide?
This one?
Yes, that one. Why do we only need one offset bit if it has 4 bytes?
These are 2 bytes. Because there's 2 entries there. Sorry. It's just an inconsistency. I write the right block size here and not there. And in the box. Okay, so we have this conflict miss problem here, which is a general problem with direct map caches. And the solution, which you may have seen in your reading, is adding associativity. So what we're going to do, instead of what we did before, having one block in each set, is we're going to have multiple blocks in each set. So for every index, we're going to have more than one place to put things. And this is going to give us a second chance for that address 0. So that address 0 will have another place to go. So hopefully, you know, we won't end up needing to throw it away just because there are some coincidences in the address. So we have the same amount of data, the 2-byte blocks again, in the cache here. Same amount of stuff. We just arranged it differently. Well, almost the same amount of stuff, because it turns out we're going to need an extra tag of it. Since we lost an index bit in order to have less rows, that means we need to put that bit somewhere to know what we have in the cache, and it's going to be in our tag. So our division of our addresses, we have the same block offset bit, and one extra tag bit, and one less index bit, because we only have 2 rows to choose between. And if we apply this access pattern as before, you know, something similar happens. But when we get to accessing address 0 here, we didn't have to get rid of the value we loaded earlier, because we have 2 places to put values which have a 0 in the index. Yes?
How do we choose which one of the 2 to replace?
We'll get to that in a bit. Right now, we haven't had to, because one thing we'll definitely do is here, you know, we have to load 6-1. We're probably going to load it in the invalid entry. That's a good choice. We could replace the other entry, but probably a very poor choice. But when we're at this point, and we want to, say, load address 6-4, then we have to actually make a choice. And there's going to be multiple options for how we do that, and I'll get to that in a bit. And note that this wasn't in the same row before, but because we have less index bits, this address 6-4 now is. Because it has just that 0 that matters, not the 1-0. So we can extend our picture of how we actually determine whether something is a hit and get a value to the processor to handle this case with associative cache. So as before, we take the index part of the address and send that to this memory to get a row out. And our row, instead of containing one piece of data and one tag and one valid bit, contains 2 copies of that. And in parallel, our hardware is going to look at each copy. So our first copy here, we're going to check the tag and see if it's equal. We're going to check the valid bit. And if so, that's a hit. For our second copy, we do the same thing. And only one of them is going to be a hit, because hopefully we don't have 2 copies of the same memory address in our cache. And if one of them's a hit, we just want to select the correct one. So this is true, this signal here. We want to select the bottom wire, bottom input to the mux, as what we actually give to the processor. And if none of them are hits, we don't really care what's on here because we're going to tell the processor it's not ready. And just as before, we have our logic for dealing with the offset. We take the offset and so you send it to another mux to select which byte of the cache block we use. So questions about this picture? Okay, so let's then return to our question of where do we insert a value? Which of these two entries do we replace when we run out of room? Before, we didn't have a choice, so it didn't matter. We had one thing to replace, and we were going to replace it. Now we have a choice. So for locality, the assumption we usually want to make is that if a value was used recently, it's going to be used again. So the typical replacement policy we'll aim for is, as we mentioned last time, least recently used. And our least recently used policy we can't actually do with this picture. We don't know which one is least recently used unless we peek at this access pattern, and we're not going to store that in our cache. But we want to remember which entry is least recently used. And a way of doing that, for these, since we have two entries, is we can just track which one was used last. And every time we access something, we can just update this entry. We can say, every time I access an entry, I'm going to set the index of the other part of the row to be the least recently used. So that's some work to do on every read, so it's not free, but it lets us accurately keep track of whether something was accessed recently and take advantage of locality. So given that we've been told that the entry with index 1, which is 0, then 1, this one is least recently used, we can make our decision to replace that second entry. And that's what we'll actually insert. So we needed to add an extra bit to keep track of what was least recently used. But this lets us actually get, take advantage of locality. Now, least recently used isn't our only option for a replacement policy. But it's the most commonly used because it takes advantage of locality. The disadvantage is that it's a bit tricky to implement. So for this two-way cache, where we had two things in a set, we have to do extra work on every read. It's not that cheap. And if we have more things in a row, we're going to need log 2 of the number of things factorial to store that information at least, and probably more. And that ends up being expensive when you have very wide rows in your cache. Which means that a lot of processors use an approximation so they can keep track of less data and make the bookkeeping simpler. And a good approximation will use bits purport, 1 or 2 times the number of things in a row. And they're an approximation, so usually they'll identify the actually least recently used thing, but sometimes they'll identify the fourth most recently used, least recently used thing instead of the actual least recently used. Things like that. But they're at least not going to choose something that you just used, which is the big problem with getting this wrong. You don't want to evict something you just put in. Yeah?
When you're saying row, you're talking about what the book calls a set.
Yes.
Not a line.
Yes, a set. What I've been drawing as horizontal. So another, sorry. Yes, the line that was least recently used.
Oh, right.
Yeah. The what line that wasn't most recently used, yeah.
So why for an 8-way cache when you just count up to 8 and then add 1 to every other cache?
So that scheme uses uses 3 bits for every entry of the cache.
And it doesn't work. If I access the first and the second and the first and the second and the first and the second, I don't want thirds counter to keep going up and up and up.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, so there's two problems, yeah. So the approximations use less information than that does and actually are handle cases where you access 1, then 2, 1, then 2, then 1, then 2, then 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 1, 2, so on. We're not going to talk about the details of how these approximations work, but just that they exist because you're actually implementing this exactly, like in HCL2D, would be pretty annoying. So another easier replacement policy is first in, first out. So this takes some advantage of locality because you're at least replacing a value which you got from memory a while ago. And it's way, way easier to implement. In particular, you just keep a counter of what you inserted last and increment it every time you write. You don't do anything on reads. It's pretty easy to implement, and some real processors have done it for that reason because it's not horrible and it works. And the simplest implement policy, which, yes, there are real processors which do, is random. You don't need to store any information. You just choose at random. And it turns out not to be that bad. So questions about replacement policies, general? So, yeah.
If you want to pick a random index, do you have to have like a full pseudo random number generator to do that, or are there like easier ways of making like less ideal pseudo random numbers?
I mean, I don't know what you think a full pseudo random number generator is. It's relatively easy to implement a okay pseudo random number generator in hardware, and that's typically what processors which do this do. And that might seem expensive, but you have to remember there's one copy of the pseudo-random number generator for the entire cache. Whereas with all these other replacement policies where we store information for each thing in the cache, we need something for each set. And that's where the big savings is. So these are some replacement policies. Usually you'll on desktop processors, you'll see something like LRU. But the other things do exist. So this replacement came up because we had associativity. And we can generally say that if a cache has so many things in each set, that it's X-way set associative. That means it has X blocks in every set. And that's the general name we'll use. And there are two special cases that have special names that you should know. So one of them is the example I started with, which is direct map. That's what we call a one-way set associative cache. We just call it direct map. And it has the special case that you don't need to worry about the replacement policy because you don't have a choice. Another special name is fully associative. This is the case where the number of blocks per set is equal to the number of sets. So everything is in one big set. So if we have a fully associative cache then, how many index bits does it have? Zero. As people are saying, zero index bits. We don't use any index bits because we don't have to choose a set. We only have one possibility. So we won't be seeing fully associative caches for memory, but they are used for other types of caches. Typically won't be seeing them for memory. Okay, so we've added associativity, and I showed you formulas earlier for relating to like cache size and number of index and offset bits. So let's extend those to handle associativity. And with the formulas I showed you before, the only thing that we need to change was what happens for the cache size. So our cache doesn't just have one block in each set, but it has some number, E in this case, of blocks per set. And the number of blocks per set is sometimes called the number of ways. And each column of blocks is sometimes called a way. So our cache size, and this is still excludes things like valid bits and tag bits, is going to be the size of each block times the number of sets times the number of blocks we have in each set. But that doesn't actually affect the other formulas here for determining index bits and offset bits. So since actually figuring out where things go in caches is very important, let's look at how we split up an address for some real caches. So the way you can figure this out is basically you're going to want to do algebra. It's probably the most systematic way of going about it. And here are a bunch of formulas. And you're just solving for the number of offset bits, index bits, and tag bits, and using that to apply to the address. And I've given you here the sizes of caches on my laptop. So my laptop has a 32 kilobyte 8-way L1 cache, a 256 kilobyte 4-way L2, and a 4 megabyte 16-way L3, and they all have 64 byte blocks. So from that information, you should be able to figure out, given this memory address, how does it divide into tag, index, and offset? So take out some paper and try to do that, and discuss with a person next to you about how you should start doing this. See if you have the same approach. So who thinks they have a good start on this? Who thinks they have no clue about what they're doing? Really, no volunteers? Okay, in between. So if you're stuck, my recommendation is to start by figuring out the block offset bits. And it's probably the easiest. And if you're stuck after that, you probably need to use the cache size for something. And just look at all the formulas it appears in and try to use it. You should not.
Okay.
Yeah, how do you wrap? Keeping in mind that those kilobytes are 1,024 bytes.
Divided by 4. All right. this as
3, 4.
All right, and then log this here, 3, 4 is 6 again. We've got 6 tag bits, 6 index bits, sorry. 6 blocks.
Yes.
Usually bigger than the L2 cache.
What? Usually they're. So your question is caches are. Yeah, usually the higher the number, the bigger they are.
Okay. Because earlier you showed us that picture of like the L2 cache taking up most of the thing, and I didn't see the L3 cache at all.
Because there was no L3 cache on that process.
Okay.
Because it was old.
Okay.
Let's do it again. Right. So we're gonna have 64 byte blocks again. So if we use 6s this time is gonna be 256,024 divided by 1,004. S is now 4096 times 1004 divided by 64 byte blocks times 16 blocks per set. 4096 UR goes to 4096.
Okay, so it seems quieter. So who thinks they have most of the answer for one of the caches? Okay. Anyone would volunteer to explain how some part of their answer and how they got it? Okay.
All right. So first, you can get the block size, so it's big B, mm-hmm. 64. So you can get little b, big B, which is 6.
Yeah. So you use this formula to get to take 64 equals 2 to the b, and that gives you, and you solve this for little b, given 64 bytes. And if you don't remember how to do this, you take the log base 2 of both sides of the equation. This, by the way, is probably the biggest reason why we covered powers of 2 at the beginning of the semester, because they come up all over this problem. Yeah, quick.
Then we're also given E, which is 8x.
Yes.
And we're also given C, and C is equal to big B times big S times big B.
Yeah, so next thing we want to do is probably find the number of sets. And the way we can do that is with this cache size formula. And you mentioned, yeah, we have E, we have B, and we have C. So for the L1 cache, C is 32 kilobytes. These are power of 2 kilobytes, not power of 1,000 kilobytes. It's pretty annoying to make a cache where most things aren't powers of 2, so we don't do that. And since we know E and B, we can just solve this for S and plug in our numbers, and we find out that the L1 cache has 64 sets. So that doesn't get us to how we use that in the address, but just like before, we have our formula, which uses the number of set index bits and the number of sets together. And just as before, we solve this by taking the log base 2. So we get that log base 2 of 64, which is 6, is the number of set index bits. And the tag is simply everything else that's left over. I didn't actually give you the length of the address because it's not really important for splitting it up. So if you repeat this process and replace 32 kilobytes and 8 with the sizes and number of ways in each of the other caches, you can get answers for everything. And these are the answers I got, and they're hopefully correct. So we have the same number of block offset bits because the block size was the same in each of these caches. And that's very common to have all the block sizes the same because it simplifies communicating between the caches. And the set number of sets varied, and so the number of set index bits varies. And the tag bits is just whatever's left over. So this is half of the problem, because we figured out how many of each type of bit there are in the address. But the question was actually to take an address and split it up into these components. So we have our sizes, and we have our address. And for the purpose of doing this, it's going to be convenient to write it in binary. And hopefully you can understand this trick here, which is I have this hex value, and I'm going to write out each hex digit as binary and just put that together to write it out in binary and make it easy to think about. And we know that the tag and index and offset bits always appear in the same order in the address. The offset bits are always the least significant bits of the address, followed by the index bits, followed by the tag bits. So if we know where the how many offset bits there are, we know that they're at the least significant part of the address. So they're, in particular, these bits at the end. And since we have the same number of offset bits in each case, they're always the same bits. So our offset is hex 27. Then the bits just before the offset are a tag. So in the case of the L1 cache, we have 6 of them, because that's the number we computed solving for little s. So we take these 6 bits, and we can write them as a hex decimal number, as hex 15. Then everything that's left over, everything we didn't use already for the L1, is our tag. In that case, this is these top 2 nibbles, so hex 34. So questions about this procedure? Yes.
You said this is for your computer. What did you have 64 byte words
in? I didn't tell you what the size of the tag was. I just told you what part of the address goes in the tag. And I'm not just writing, I'm not writing leading zeros. Okay. So they're leading zeros, yes. So yes, but you'd think my computer probably has 64 byte addresses. That's not actually correct, but we haven't gone into that. But it doesn't matter for the problem because it's just everything left over in the address, and it's going to start with zeros over any. We didn't ask you to write out all the bits, just what part of it split up the address. Yes?
Yeah, I'm a little confused as to where the offset bits came from.
The calculation? The number of offset bits, or how we decided where they were?
How you decided where they were.
So the rule is that the order is this acronym up here, tag, then index, then offset. So the tag bits are first, then the index bits, then at the end, the offset bits. So we know if we have an address, the bits for the offset are always at the end. That's just the rule. And that's because what we store in a block in the cache is from memory addresses which are next to each other in memory. And the offset bits chooses between different things in the same block. So it needs to be the least significant bits, the ones at the end of the number. Other questions? So if you do all the work, you'll get these answers, unless I made a mistake. I assume most of you didn't get that far. This is an important procedure to do in the future, because if we want to ask you how does a cache behave, it's really important to know, are you going to have conflicts? Are two things going to replace each other or not? You know, are two addresses in the same block or not? These are questions that are useful to know for performance and also for like exams. So this is a procedure you should be familiar with, because if we ask you how a cache is behaving, you probably need to know how to split up addresses for it. Okay, so that's about how hashes split up addresses, but we've missed a big part of what caches do, which is that we haven't talked about how they write. So we've only seen reading from caches, but that's not all we do. We also write to memory, and we'd like caches to help us with that somehow, at least in the sense of being possible to send a write, since we have to talk to the cache to talk to memory and have it work. So our CPU wants to send a write to the cache, and the cache needs to do something with it. The simplest thing it can do is called write through. It's going to just forward the write to memory all the time. In doing this, it's also going to probably update its copy of the value if it has it cached. But the simplest policy is the cache just always writes to memory, and that's a real policy some caches implement. Another option is the cache cannot write to memory. It can just store the value that was written. It can say, okay, you wrote to address ABCD. I'm going to remember what you wrote, and I'm going to remember that it's different than memory. Then later on, we'll have to take this value and need to replace it in the cache. But we'll know that it's what's called dirty, that it's different than memory. And that will tell us that, okay, since we're reading this conflicting value and replacing it, we need to write back what this changed value to memory. If we didn't write it back, we would lose that value. And you can have a program where you wrote something to memory, and you read it later, and you don't read your update. That's not allowed. So we need to make sure someone has a copy of it before we get it out of our cache. And the way we do that is by adding yet another column to our cache. So for each cache block, in addition to storing a valid bit and a tag bit, if we want to implement this write-back policy, we're going to store information about whether the block is dirty, whether it's different than memory. And if that's set, that means that if this block is evicted, we need to write it to memory rather than just throwing it away. So I think that's all I have for today. So next time we'll talk about performance in caches, both in how we choose how to design a cache and how you as a programmer can use a cache effectively.